Hello, and welcome to Conversations Towards Reconciliation with Alderville First Nations Chief Tainar Simpson. I'm your host, Robert Washburn. This program is coming to you from the Williams Treaty Territory and Northumberland 89.7 FM. For the next 30 minutes, we will bring you important stories and issues facing Indigenous and non-Indigenous people living here in Northumberland County and across the country. It is your chance to become better informed, more engaged, and empowered as we all move together on the path to reconciliation. So join us for the next step on this journey. Once again, I am in conversation with Alderville First Nations Chief Tainar Simpson. Good to see you once again, Chief.
You too. It's a Merry Christmas special edition, I think.
Recently, you attended the Assembly of First Nations annual meeting where the Memorandum of Understanding between the federal government and Alberta was debated. What was at the heart of that discussion?
Well, I think the Memorandum of Understanding is a far-reaching memorandum that has a number of issues, some good and some maybe not so good. On the good side, you have the carbon capture, which I think is a necessity for reducing our carbon footprint in Canada moving forward. But of course, one of the big issues was the streamlining of pipelines and specifically in through the northern communities in northern BC. So to First Nations, this is mostly a non-starter, just because we know that eventually you're going to get an Exxon Valdez type event in the northern corridor, which would be detrimental to all ways of life up there, not just Indigenous. So I think there was a unanimous opposition to that within the Assembly of First Nations of everyone who was there.
The Exxon Valdez, just for people who may not remember, took place in Alaska's Prince William Sound on March 24th of 1989. It was very serious, and it took a very long time, and there was a lot of environmental damage, if I'm recalling correct. Is that your memory?
Yes, that is. I remember when people would go up north to help clean off the geese with the dish soap, and they used those toothbrushes, and it was quite an event. And you got the tar balls coming up for about a couple years afterwards, and it was in such a pristine area, so that the damage caused there is it's really, you can't undo damage like that to the wildlife.
Why a tanker ban instead of just a general ban on any new pipelines?
Well, I think the tanker, even if it doesn't spill oil through a crash, it still pollutes the streams that it's going to have to go through. And then it goes off into the islands and the inner passage. So I think it's going to leave that constant oil slick from the boats. And of course, there's a lot of beluga whales, there's killer whales, there's seals that do get hit by boats and the boat traffic. So I think it's just a big disturbance. And I'm not sure if they've been looking at, say, a further south pipeline that can maybe get to Vancouver or something. So I think that the main opposition was to that northern access.
Fair enough. But you could have taken a position as an organization to say, look, we don't want any pipeline at all. Let's forget tankers. Let's be against the pipeline itself. But that's not the position you took. I'm trying to draw a distinction between why wasn't there just a general pipeline ban that said we don't want a pipeline versus just focusing on as you've spoken already, about tankers.
Well, I think the AFN tries to play it careful. They represent all First Nations, and I don't think that it's unanimous that First Nations are against pipelines. I do think that some First Nations see pipelines as an economic driver, and it would be up to them to decide if they are interested in one. So I think even though AFN is a political organization, I think taking too political of a stance on that might have been what stopped them from the overall pipeline ban. But of course, it's something that we're going to be discussed. I don't think most First Nations are in favor of pipelines, but I know some are. So I think that needs more discussion.
There's also something that doesn't get talked about much, but was alluded to at the meetings, and that was the approach to consultation with Indigenous people. There seems to be a pattern where decisions are made and then consultations take place afterwards. And it seems Indigenous people often push back, seeking prior consultation. And like I said, it seems that there's this pattern. Why do you think governments and business follow this path rather than seeking prior consultation?
Yes, we saw that with Bill 5 and Bill C-5 earlier in the year when they said, okay, after we pass these laws, we're going to consult with you. The idea would have been to consult with us on those bills. They didn't consult with anybody in the Canadian public. The bills were rammed so quickly through Parliament and became law without much discussion. So I think that's the old way of doing what they would call consultation. So we think that there shouldn't be anything about us without us at the table. So if you're going to be discussing major issues that are going to affect Indigenous territories or Indigenous people, we need to be at that table right from the get-go, not after the fact, not after a big agreement's been signed or a big law's been passed. We need to be at that table from the get-go.
But oftentimes there seems to be a sense that, or at least a concern that prior consultation takes longer, there's delays, things don't seem to get done as quickly. How do you respond to those types of concerns?
Well, I do know that consultation could go faster than it does. We are always ready to sit down with our neighbors, with our the other politicians around Canada. But quite often, the delay is not on our side; it's on the Crown side or on the industry side, where they maybe haven't put aside enough time, or they put consultation near the end of a project and not maybe earlier, where we could have made it more smooth. So the whole idea of consultation is to come to agreements on how to move forward with as little delay to what might be happening down the road. So I think intelligent, strategic consultation is the key because some things do take some time, especially when you do look at that archaeology or the environmental aspects that need to be considered.
Is it about power sharing?
I believe it is because the government, as we know, doesn't like to share power. They believe that the way that the course that they've taken is going to be the best course of action. They feel that they're correct in how they want to move ahead. But at the same time, there is always room for improvement. And this is where we come in with consultation. So we try to bring new ideas. We try to look at things from a different angle, if you will, in terms of how everyone can be involved in say, a project and its decision-making process.
Another major resolution at the meeting was the boil water advisories. Now, I understand there are still 37 long-term water advisories. This is on top of the 37 short-term advisories. Now, what was said on this issue?
Well, I think this is something that the Liberal government has been promising for quite some time to end all boiled water advisories on First Nations. And really anywhere in Canada that has a boiled water advisory, that should be setting off alarm bells and say, hey, we need to get a good water system in these communities. So apparently it's a lot harder than it is just to say we're going to do it. So we're looking at some of the communities that have had a boiled water advisory for decades. And these are really the ones that have been the poster child children for these initiatives. And I still don't quite understand why they haven't been taken care of. It seems like we know what the problem is. We know what the solution is. And you think it'd just be a matter of fixing it. Of course, it's that's not happening in our community. We did have a boiled water advisory, but it was taken care of after a few years. So we see it as something once it's identified, we should go off and fix it. So we don't quite understand why it's such taking so long for some communities, which is why it came to the AFN table again for further discussion and advocacy.
Can you explain what's at the heart of this? Rather than just talking about it generally as boil water, what are the barriers?
I think mostly it's infrastructure. So you would be looking at having a water system, and then you would also probably want some sort of a wastewater system to go with it. You want to make sure that you're getting a source of water that starts out relatively clean, if that's groundwater, or say something from a river or a stream. You definitely want to have a good clean source of water to start. And if you don't, that will depend, that'll make decide how you're going to go forward with your infrastructure. So what kind of a water plant you would need, how in depth it would need to be to correct the water. And then you also have to have a means of delivering that water either through pipes or a community well project. So I think this is where a lot of it gets bogged down, where they just aren't able to put in the proper infrastructure. And then also it takes a lot of technicians that need training to be able to manage that infrastructure.
Well, it's just because the government says that it's lifted 149 advisories since 2015, and yet the number seems to stall after 2020, with only 23 being lifted in the last 4 years. What is holding things up? I mean, is it missing studies? Is there a process that needs to be put in place? I mean, when you ask for something to be done, what is it that you actually pass that says, here, we need you to do this?
Yes. So I guess it all comes down to dollars and cents. These water treatment systems, they're fairly expensive, especially when you're looking at more remote communities. I'd have to guess it just comes down to the dollar figure. And people are probably like, that's way too expensive. But at the same time, it's our health. If you look at the health conditions of people in communities where there's boiled water advisories, they're hitting much lower on all of the different health factors that are measurable. So there's really no better way to increase the health of a community than to have clean drinking water for them.
Another issue that got debated was the criminalizing of residential school denialism. There was a private member's bill introduced in September of 2024 in the House of Commons to add the promotion of hatred against Indigenous people. Now, that bill died when the federal election was held in January of this year. What does the AFN seek on this issue?
I think they seek a law similar to Holocaust denial from World War II. So this is something that we know that there were deniers of the Holocaust, and it was equated to hate speech. So I think what we're trying to do with this is basically, we know residential schools happen. We know that thousands upon thousands of students perished at these schools. The treatment of the students was beyond awful. We call them survivors because they survived the schools. So this was part of a way to assimilate First Nation people, to eliminate culturally, linguistically, and socially Indigenous nations, and to try to bring them into the Canadian way of life. So it was a way to destroy people, cultures and societies, and we want to make sure that it's identified as such, that you can't deny that this happened, because we know that it happened. We know how deadly it was. And when people start denying it, it creates more confusion, and also it allows for that parallel misinformation to keep going on. And to deny that this happens is, to me, frankly, I don't understand how anyone could do that.
But is the narrative simply saying that the deaths at residential schools did not take place, or something like, well, where's the proof, or is it something more nefarious?
Well, I believe that some people are just misinformed, but I do believe that there is a nefarious factor there by denying that students were killed, by pretending, I can find a hole in this argument. We see it a lot in certain media where they've taken that issue where they are denying it, that it's part of the narrative that they're selling. And of course, it always comes back to, it's just because Indigenous people want more and they're asking for more. And you see it in the comments section of all the news agencies that allow it to happen. It's quite horrible if you actually read it. And sadly, even in our own area, we see that a lot too. So it's something that we always have to be aware about. We are here. We've been here for a long time, and we are just trying to make our own way, like we always have. And to get the amount of hate thrown at us that we receive for just surviving is it's quite frustrating and sad.
Let me be the devil's advocate for just a moment. Why is it wrong to be skeptical? I mean, is it not healthy to have a critical thinking as part of our society?
I think that once the facts are out there, It doesn't make sense to argue the facts once the facts have been established. This is something that I've worked on for 25 plus years with the residential schools research. So this is where I was involved in all aspects of the research for the survivors, looking for the missing children, identifying the students who passed away. So I know these are facts. I know how many thousands of students passed away at these schools. So then when you hear people saying that it's not true and starting to question those facts, that is the problem, because we know this happens. You can't really be skeptical about these facts when that's like saying the sky is blue and then someone's saying, no, I think it's red. You know that it's blue, and we know that these students died. We know how horrible these schools were.
There are those, though, that will frame this as saying it's an attack on free speech. What do you say to them?
Well, I mean, free speech is a very misunderstood term, because you have threats. Threats come out of speech. We know that you're not allowed to do that. That's breaking a law. That's not free speech. You're threatening somebody. So when you're going off and denying that the atrocities were committed against Indigenous people, you're basically allowing for that to, you're giving that a free pass that it happened, and that no justification for that needs to happen. So I figure that it's a way to get the historic crown off the hook for the damages caused to Indigenous nations. And of course, who benefits from denying that? It's everybody but Indigenous people. So this is something that we've had to take a hard stance against.
Now, in terms of what you're asking for, are you asking that the private members bill previously be reintroduced, or are you looking for new legislation?
I think however it can get done. We just want to see that law similar to the Holocaust denial law. So however that can get on the books is how we will approach it.
I also understand that there was a special commemoration of Elijah Harper. Can you remind us who he was and tell us what happened at the meeting?
Okay, so for those that remember, I believe it was in the late 80s when the Meech Lake Accord was going on. And this was something that they were going to reframe the Constitution. Indigenous people had been left out of the new Constitution and how things were going to be discussed. So what Canada needed was they needed all of the provincial legislators basically to be unanimous for the Meech Lake Accord to pass. And when it came to Manitoba's time, Elijah Harper had a seat at the legislation in the province, and he did not vote for the Meech Lake Accord. He cast the one opposition vote that ended up killing Meech Lake Accord for the entire country. And this is when the discussion really started about how do we ingrain Indigenous people into the Constitution? How do we recognize Indigenous people as a unique people that had basically just been whitewashed and ignored? So I think that's when that conversation started. And of course, that led to the Charleston Accord, which did recognize the inherent rights of First Nations in Canada. But of course, during the referendum, that the Charleston Accord was defeated. But it did start the conversation. Even though both of those accords fell through, it did allow for that discussion for First Nations to be at the tables. And we've been there ever since. So he was a major force, very well-spoken, but he also wasn't going out to create a scene. He was just doing what he thought was the right thing to do.
So what happened at the meeting then?
So we honored the history of Elijah Harper. We had a few elders come in and talk about him. And the event ended with the blanketing ceremony for his daughter. So his daughter, who was actually about my age, I think she's a year older than me, she she accepted a blanket, and then through ceremony, the elders put the blanket around her, and then we had a ceremony for her, and it was quite a powerful, moving situation, and everyone just stood up, and people did share any memories they had with about Elijah. I was fairly young when it happened, but I remember how significant of an event it was at the time.
I was wondering, do you have an update on the situation with the personhood of Rice Lake? Can you bring us up to speed? Because that we talked about that in our last episode. What have you got to tell us this time?
Well, I'm going to say that it definitely it made the news on several fronts. I was doing a number of interviews for the couple weeks after that. So there was a good press and there was maybe not so good press. But the fact is that it got the conversation going. I've got meetings set up with a lot of the townships coming forward. I've had meetings with local townships since. So I think it's really coming along. It's I point people to our podcast because it's a good primer for trying to understand what the next steps would be. So anytime that I'm about to meet with a council, I'll say, hey, maybe check with the podcast because they're going to ask those questions. So I think we've gotten some really good positive feedback all across the country. And generally it's been well accepted. Once people understand what legal personhood is and that it's going to be a benefit to Rice Lake, it's not going to bring people's property values down. It's not saying that new laws are coming on. There's been a lot of misconceptions that have come out that we've been able to address, knowing that that's the questions that are coming. But overall, it's been well received by the vast majority of media and people I've spoken to.
You've talked about this on a much larger scale. How about locally? How many calls to the band office, and what are you hearing as you travel around Rice Lake and from the residents and businesses that that are there?
Well, I think in Alderville, it's been very well received. We know the importance of Rice Lake and how it can sustain people through food and through fish, and just a great place to spend your time. And we want to spread that message out to everybody along the lake. Yeah, we're still getting out. We do get the occasional call, but for the most part, I think people have been relying on the media coverage to get their answers. So I've gotten a number of emails, but I'm not going to say it's been an onslaught of emails. I think for the most part, people are going out and researching this on their own to figure out what it's about. But of course, if you're a part of a town or community along the lake, at some point I'll probably be in your area presenting to your council about this. So I'm sure that that might even provide you an opportunity to come and hear for yourself and ask questions about it.
Have you got some public service announcements for us?
I sure do. As we know, Christmas is coming up, so we do have our band office that's closing down for 2 weeks. So this coming week of January 15th is going to be our last week that we're open. But we do have some announcements and programming going on through there. So let's see, on December 18th, this is a plug for the Aeron Theater. The Art of the Solstice is happening. So it's a winter evening of Indigenous dance, craft, and poetry. So that's at 6:30. I'm giving it a plug because I think it's a fairly significant event, even though it's not happening in Alderville. We have on January 8th and 22nd, we have a winter craft night. So it's from 3 to 7 p.m. at Hilltop. You can contact Jessica and Aiden if you want to sign up for that. Also on January 23rd, we have a vaccine education supper at 5 p.m. Please call Dawn Marie if you're interested in having supper and learning more about vaccines and how they can prevent preventable disease. On January 23rd and 24th, we have an entrepreneur workshop. And this is something that there's a virtual option as well. So you can attend in person or you can attend in virtual. If you have an idea to start a business or you want to learn how to start your business, please contact Robin to register January 23rd and 24th. On January 10th, skipping back a little bit, we have a second generation community meeting. So anyone who's interested in learning more about the second generation cutoff and the changes to the legislation, this is Bill S2 that's currently making its way through the House. This is your chance to come out and learn more about that. It's a major issue affecting First Nations in Canada, and it's something that we are going to be seeing some changes to the Indian Act. Let's see. So coming up again on January 23rd, it's a pretty big day. Everything points to it. We have a February hand drum workshops. So if you want to attend the two workshops in February, you need to sign up by January 23rd by contacting Jessica. So other than that, I just want to wish everyone a safe and happy holidays. Don't eat too much and drive safe on those roads.
Well, Chief, I'd like to wish you the best of the season. And thank you so much for talking to me today.
No, thank you.
I want to thank Alderville First Nations Chief Tainar Simpson for talking to me today. I want to thank you for joining our conversation, and I hope you enjoyed this time to learn more about what's going on, the stories and issues facing Indigenous people living in Northumberland and elsewhere. That's all for this week. I'm Robert Washburn. Join us again next time for Conversations Towards Reconciliation with Tainar Simpson.